My name's Tarek. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and a member of Cocaine Anonymous.
Hey, Tarek.
And before we move forward, I got a question. By a show of hands, who has more experience with drugs than you do with alcohol? Okay. So we're looking at a little over almost two-thirds of the room. When I speak in Alcoholics Anonymous, I observe singleness of purpose. So I share about my experience with alcohol, my relationship with alcohol, and I talk about the spiritual experience that's happened in my life as a result of applying the 12 steps, putting them into practical application. But because this is the first meeting, and Matt and I were talking about what fellowship, you know, this meeting was going to fall under, you know, there are other fellowships. It's really important that we find the identification. You know, the big book's very clear. It says we are properly armed with facts about ourselves as a result of working the 12 steps, and we can generally win the entire confidence of another individual in a few short hours. Now, I speak crackhead language. I'm a crackhead. I can identify with a crackhead in 10 or 15 minutes. It takes me longer with a meth addict, a little bit longer with an opiate addict, and longer with an alcoholic. It can be done. But when I sit down and I start chopping it up with a fellow crackhead, the identification is built quickly, and I have convinced them quickly that I know where they're at, and I don't go there anymore. So as a result of identification, the chance of success goes up because they're more likely to follow the directions that I give them when they're convinced that I know what they're going through. The whole foundation, the reason we're sitting here tonight with Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob, that's what really floored Dr. Bob the first time he sat down with Bill Wilson, was that Bill identified with him. For the first time, Bob had someone that explained what alcoholism was, what his hopeless condition was, that once he started, he couldn't stop, and once he stopped, he always went back, even though he didn't want to. And that's the baffling feature of alcoholism and drug addiction, the utter inability to leave it alone, no matter how great the necessity or the wish. So it's important, since the room is predominantly addicts tonight, that I'm going to share parts of both my experiences, because it's important that if someone in here hears something tonight, that they have an open mind. So I know I've been doing this long enough to know that the majority of people sitting in this room tonight aren't going to remember a word I've said after this meeting is over. But there might be that one or two people in here that are going to hear that one thing that makes everything sort of click, and they start to see something a little bit differently, and they start to do something they may have never done before. And that if that happens, then, you know, I've been used. I've served my purpose. A power greater than myself separated me from crack cocaine on the morning of November 5th in 2007. Man, it seems like a long time ago. I wasn't looking to come back to AA or CA at that point. I wasn't trying to check into a sober living or a halfway house or a treatment center. I was traveling around the country following this band around called Whitesburg Panic. And God dressed up as a bunch of police officers, and they arrested me, and I was separated, and that began a journey for me. I'd been on the journey ever since I came into this body, but there was a significant shift in my experience on that date. For years, I was a guy that thought I was an addict, and as a result of circumstance, I was molested, you know, by a family member from age 5 to 7, so that must be why I'm an alcoholic or a drug addict. For some of us, we say that to ourselves. If you knew what I had gone through, then you would got high too. I know a lot of people now that have had that same experience, but they didn't end up alcoholic or addict. So that smashes the belief system. I was abandoned. I love my mother tremendously. She didn't have the capacity to deal with a violent alcoholic husband who was physically abusive to my mother as well as my brother and I. So they would have their arguments. My brother was 3, I was 5, and my mom would just lose it. She'd start screaming and pulling her hair, grabbing her purse. And she'd storm out the door, said, "I'm never coming back," and she would get in this car and drive off. And me and my brother would sit by this window in the dining room just waiting. And the street coming towards the place where we lived, you could only see two headlights. And we would sit there and imagine every set of headlights was my mom coming back home. Sometimes she was gone for a couple hours. Sometimes she was gone all night. And that created an effect. It was a traumatic effect on me. That gave birth to so many ideas around being alone, around women, around security, that have bled into other parts of my life as I grew older. You know, but I used to think, you know, if someone else had that traumatic event, they would drink too, or they would get high too. I know people that have had events much worse than that happen in their lives. They didn't travel the path of drugs and alcohol. So that can't be why I'm an alcoholic and or a drug addict. My father was much older than all the other fathers. He was 41 or 42 when I was born. He never went to a basketball game. He never remembered my birthday. When I turned 18, I didn't really have a relationship with him because I rarely went home. There were times when I lived there and he was always in the basement and I was really never home, although I called that home at the time. He was also, you know, physically, emotionally, verbally abusive. And I will tell you, fast forward a little bit, and I hope to come back to this later, but just side note, if I tell you I'm about to come back to this later, it means I may not come back to it. But my father and I ended up building a very strong relationship based on the amends that I made to him. After the description I just gave you, I made an amends to my father when I first got clean and sober that restored that relationship and made it whole. But for a while, you know, if I'd had a real dad, I wouldn't have gone down this path. And that just was not true, because I know a lot of individuals who didn't have a father who did not travel the path of drugs and alcohol. So I'm an addict for two reasons. Once I start, I cannot stop. And once I stop, I always start up again. It's simple. I've never understood some of these other fellowships that have 100 questions to determine your first step. I understand what they're trying to do, but that's how simple it is. And your experience is going to tell the truth. Experience does not lie. Our mind will lie to us. The interesting thing about the first step is once you've accepted it and you see the truth in it, which is the, you know, I'm not a big believer in the one word principles behind the steps, but I think if I had to choose the principle behind the first step would be desperation or hopelessness. The more hopeless you are when you get here, the more hope there is for your recovery. It's just one of the many paradoxes we have in these 12 steps in our big book, in our fellowships. And once you accept your first steps, are surrendered in your first step, working the rest of the steps is pretty easy because you are willing to submit to a way other than your own. But as long as you're in denial of your first step, which means you reject it, or as long as you're delusional around your first step, but your mind says, you know, I'm going to go back to when I could get high on Thursday and Friday and chill out Saturday and do the stuff I got to do on Sunday, then I go back to work to Monday. Because that was my deal. I thought I was going to do OCs and smoke crack on the weekends. That was the delusion. And what happened was I had actual friends that were attorneys and successful in business that could do that. They were what I called the weekend warriors. And for years, that delusion kept me trying it over and over. I'm intellectually smart. If they can do it, I must be able to do it. But I couldn't, because I'd lost power, choice, and control. And I bounced in and out. I started going to meetings in 2004. My sobriety date's November 5th, 2007. You know, I went to a treatment center not far from here a couple times. Been in a halfway house near here. I used to live up in Cummings. I'm very familiar with this area. But the last time when I was incarcerated, I fully accepted the drastic proposals outlined in the big book, because I'd been to big book studies. I'd been to really good meetings before. I knew what I was going back to. A lot of people say they didn't come here looking for God. When I sat in the Jacksonville, in Duval County, in Jacksonville, Florida, incarcerated, I knew it. I was going to come back to these rooms because a relationship with some type of God was going to be my only answer. I knew it. I'd been around long enough. But I fully accepted it. And the more people I talk to, the more I'm starting to see that a lot of people have their mental obsession removed before they ever work a step. My obsession was removed on November 5th, 2007, and has never returned. Now, I don't know what would have happened if I had not turned myself into a sponsor and been taken through that big book in a really quick fashion. I would venture to say you'd have a different speaker up here tonight. But I was blessed with a desire to attack recovery like I attacked the street. The same mentality I had out on the street followed me into the rooms. I wanted the good dope out there, so I wanted the good dope in here. I'm always fascinated because we love to out-bottom ourselves, right? We want to make sure we're the sickest person in the room and we've got the worst war story, and we describe a mad dog out in the street, and then we come into these rooms and we turn into these little ankle biter dogs, which has never made any sense to me. It's fascinating to watch how someone can talk such a hard game about being out there, but they're, excuse my language, pussies when it comes to working the 12 steps. You know, and I don't shy away. Somebody in here already doesn't like me, and that's totally okay. I've been doing this long enough that I know that's the case. You know, but I have a responsibility to carry a message of depth and weight to you. That's why I'm here. You know, I have an experience over these 11 years that I want to share with people, right? Because it gives you the hope. I'll tell you the magic. So I'm a guy that believes that alcohol and drugs would have never done so much to me if at one point they had done a tremendous amount for me. They were a source of power. They were a source of confidence. They removed fear. They quieted the mind. They gave me ease. They gave me comfort. They made me be able to sit alone in perfect peace and ease when they were still working. That's some powerful shit I just described to you. If you don't get the same thing out of these 12 steps and this process and your conception of God, the chances of you staying go down drastically. At least have the intent and the belief that it's possible. Just the willingness. And the process will create the belief. You don't have to understand the steps to work them. The actual experience of working the steps will create the understanding of the steps. But the steps are not meant to be intellectualized. They're meant to be experienced. I run a program, and they've got 2 months to get to step 9, or they don't get their phone back and they don't have a car and they can't get a job. A lot of people are always like, that's really quick to work the steps. And we keep them really busy and they're in groups all day long. Without fail, I get a guy that comes to me and he sits in the office and he says, why do we have so many activities? Why do you keep us so busy? When was the last time you thought about sticking a needle in your arm? And they get it. They get why it's so important to go through this process as quickly as possible. It can happen. The big book references 2 times, a few short weeks and a few short months. And that's what they were doing in the early days. You know, they were getting into helping others quickly, getting service commitments. That before AA was even around, we had this thing called the Oxer groups, and they were not taking their time working the steps. You've got an illness that's trying to kill you, period. Why would you, you know, if somebody's chasing you down the street with a gun, you don't take your time trying to get away from them. You run as fast as you can. But for some reason, that's not what's going on here. Take your time. Take it easy. Chill. Relax. We'll get to those steps. I don't get it. I'm not going to tell you that. I'm going to tell you that your life is on the line. You don't need a temporary sponsor. You need a permanent sponsor for a permanent problem. So I was at this pool party. I was about 14, 15 years old. Athletics was huge. I played basketball all year round. I was all county in high school, so that was my identity, and it was my sense of who I was. Early on in life, I developed this idea that if I needed to feel good on the inside, it was going to take something on the outside to make that happen. So I got my sense of who I was by what other people thought and by what I was doing, never about what's in here. And so I never had a problem making friends, but I still felt alone. Like I had something to prove. I had to be cool. I had to do all the things to get people's attention. And I would become paralyzed with fear when I was around people that didn't know that I was a a star basketball player, or they didn't know I was a smart kid in school, or they didn't know who my friends were, right? So now I had something to prove, and I would become paralyzed by this fear. And I was at this pool party, 14, 15 years old. It was at my buddy's house. His parents actually let all the kids drink. If you had a keys, you had to turn your keys in. His parents were of the philosophy, you're going to do it anyway, you might as well do it here where it's safe. That was the deal. I don't know if those kind of parents are still out there. I doubt it with the way social media is and all that stuff. But those were that was the friend. And I remember sitting, we're out by the pool, 8 feet deep on the deep end, and there was this tool shack where the lawnmower and all the tools were, and it was about 10 feet of concrete between the deep end and this shack. And all these guys were jumping up on this roof and jumping into the pool, and they were trying to impress all the girls, and I'm sitting off to the side just really paralyzed with fear. I'm afraid of heights. I'm real pale. You know, I've got freckles. I just didn't feel like I fit in. And I remember somewhere between the second and the fifth drink, alcohol did for me what I couldn't do for myself. And I had a psychic change. I had a personality change sufficient to bring about my recovery from that insecurity. And I got up on that shed and I jumped into the deep end of the pool. Something happened between the second and the fifth drink. Huge emotional displacement and rearrangement occurred in that moment. And ideas and attitudes which had been guiding me up to that point in time didn't exist. And a new set of motives and conceptions came to the surface. That's a spiritual experience. That's the big book's description of a spiritual experience. And it happened to me with alcohol. I knew I had discovered something powerful. I discovered something that worked. I had discovered a solution. Later on, people would tell me I discovered a problem. No, I discovered a solution. I graduated high school. I played basketball my first year in college. That went to hell when I got introduced to the Grateful Dead and widespread panic. And I immediately started traveling around the country. We would leave school on Thursday. We would drive 8-10 hours, go see Thursday, Friday, Saturday, sometimes come back to school on Sunday, sometimes just stay on tour. And then a few years later, I learned if I sold drugs in the parking lot that I would get my tickets for free, I'd get my drugs for free, I'd have money, and I'd have girls talking to me. And that turned into selling large quantities of drugs. And then it turned into doing it when I wasn't on tour with the bands. And in the process of all this, I did manage to graduate from college. I tried to do corporate America on 3 separate occasions. I lost all those jobs as a result of my relationship with crack cocaine. You know, alcohol was a steady fixture in my life. When the big book describes, you know, gradually impaired mentally and physically and grave, you know, it was mentally grave on me. I never had any consequences from my drinking, guys. You know, all my consequences came from crack cocaine. That's the relationship. That's the master-slave relationship. When Bill Wilson says alcohol was my master, I'd met my match, I had been overwhelmed. I can't use those words to describe my relationship with alcohol. Now, when I drink, the majority of the time I lose control. And there was a brief period of time in 2004 and 5 when I realized when I get drunk, I smoke crack. I don't want to drink anymore because I know I'm going to smoke crack, and I couldn't stay away from the first drink. So, this was my experience. Fast forward to 2007, I'm arrested with 2 drug trafficking, one intent to distribute, 1 drug trafficking charge in the state of Florida. And up to that point, I was delusional. I'd been to treatment, I'd been to IOP, I'd been to sober living, I'd been to a halfway house, and I never understood the first step. Every time I went to one of those places, I thought I was going to hang out. And then when I left, I wouldn't want to do what I was doing that got me there. And it just wasn't true. I was a meeting-making fool. I'd get up to my 4-step and wouldn't go any further. Why? Because I had not been surrendered. Now, earlier I said the first step, you know, I'm alcoholic and or addict because of these 2 reasons. There's a third, really. But to be alcoholic and or addict means you have to have a relationship with alcohol and or drugs. This other part called the spiritual malady that the big book talks about. Now, the big book talks about a 3-part problem. It says once the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. That's 3 parts. The spiritual component, though, the majority of the humans walking on this planet, they suffer from it. They have a restlessness. They have an irritability. They have a discontent. I see it in people in my family and other friends that aren't alcoholic or addict. But they have that dis-ease. They have that easily, they get easily annoyed with life and life situations. And they got this feeling that they're not satisfied and they got to keep moving. They got to keep attaining things. Some of them, they shop, right? That's where their obsession takes them. Some of them takes them to sex, some to gambling, spending money, eating food, what physical fitness, whatever it is, it's there. You and I, we go down the path of drugs and alcohol to address that. And then we get to a point where you cross this imaginary line and we've lost power, choice, and control. But the cold truth is nobody sitting in this room will ask themselves what side of the line they're on until it's too late. It's like you look around, you're like, what was that back there? Oh, that was the invisible line. And once you've crossed it, there is no going back. So it is a three-part. And these 12 steps, the way they're designed, they will treat the spiritual malady. So if someone in here is asking, well, what is a spiritual malady? All that's ever on your mind is you. That's the shortest description I got for it. There's other ways to look at it, though. You're constantly judging relationships in your life. You demand from everyone and you never give. Misery and depression might haunt you. You find yourself crippled with fear. You're unhappy. You don't like what you're doing to make a living. You can't make a living. You can't seem to be of real help to other people. Everybody gets on your nerves. You're dissatisfied the majority of the time. That's the spiritual malady. And if that thing festers long enough, that is the breeding ground for the mental obsession. And once the obsession returns, you're the proverbial screwed. Now, a lot of people think they freak out when they think, I've been thinking about getting high. I've had thoughts off and on over 11 years about getting high. It's never been an obsession. Because once it is an obsession, it's too late. Okay? If you have a competent sponsor, they should be able to share these things with you. And so that's the first, that's the three parts of that first step. The magical thing about the three legacies in Alcoholics Anonymous is they address our problem. Recovery is the 12 steps. That's the program. You're not in the program because you're in a meeting tonight. Meetings are part of the fellowship. The program's the 12 steps. And you're actively in the program when you're actively working the steps. Don't get that confused. Two separate things. In the early days, we had this program supported by a fellowship. Now we have a fellowship with an optional program. That's why, in my opinion, the success rates are so low. It's the recovery piece is the program. The unity is the fellowship. We got to get with our people. That's why it's really important that if the majority of your experience is a shooting dope, you want to go somewhere where you can freely talk about it. But when you're in an AA meeting, you have to respect Alcoholics Anonymous. If you don't have a lot of experience, there are beautiful 12-step fellowships that have been born out of Alcoholics Anonymous. Cocaine Anonymous is not drug-specific. We welcome anyone suffering from a chronic dependence on any mind-altering substance. Heroin Anonymous, they do have singles and purpose at some of their meetings. You have Crystal Meth Anonymous. It's so important that you get with your people, because if you're with your people, your roots are going to sink deeper into the soil. And when the winds of life start to blow, you're not going to get yanked out as easily. Get with your people. They talk about getting in the middle of the herd. That's what the unity is about. You know, if you work the steps, you tend to have, you begin over the course of time to think a little bit more clearly, right? In the first couple of years of sobriety and recovery, our capacity to make decisions in our highest good is drastically diminished. That's why we need the sponsor. That's why we need a couple closed-mouth friends. But if you stay on this path, your capacity to make decisions in your highest good will increase. But it's so important to have some transparent dialogue with people in your network, people around you, in your family, that are not scared to tell you the truth, even if it's going to hurt your feelings. Now, I've been observing long enough to know this is where most people fail. They do not develop networks with people that are excited about recovery. You got to have your road dogs, right? The road dogs are the people that you sit around, you chop it up, you go do stuff, you have fun. You don't have to talk about steps in God all the time. But you got to have a magical combination of the other piece of it, where you've got the people that are going to call you on your BS, they're going to tell you the truth, and they're going to hold you accountable to the things you say you're going to do. That's what that unity is all about. Getting a home group, go to group conscience on a regular basis. You know, develop those four or five people that know everything about you. Everyone in here has a dark passenger. Everyone. Not a human on this planet exists without having a darkness inside of them. The difference is some of us are going to share our darkness because it's there. We name it and we look at it and we observe it and we talk about it. It doesn't seem to consume us. There are other people, they're not going to share their darkness and they're most likely not going to stay here. So that's the unity piece. And there's the recovery priest and then the service. Matt picked up the service commitment. That's him being of service. When I sacrifice my personal time to sit down and take someone through the steps, that's a form of service. I am the group conscience chairperson for this year at my home group. That's a service commitment. I get to the meeting 2 hours before the meeting starts. Why? Because my greatest teacher in early recovery taught me about the meeting before the meeting, and the meeting after the meeting. I saw that this man had what I wanted. And we don't have to reinvent the wheel. If you find someone that displays excellence, you watch what they do and you do what they do. That's it. That's all we have to do. And this man did it. And I noticed on Friday night, he was always there like between 5:45 and 6:15. And so I started getting there between 5:45 and 6:15. This is an 8 o'clock meeting. And I would just hang out. And then I noticed how he would get the meeting set up. And then he'd come stand outside in front of the church, smoking cigarettes. And the newcomers would start to come eventually. And he would have these conversations with all of them. Then his friends would start to show up closer to like 7:30. But I saw that and it made sense to me. Now I've been doing that for the past, November will be 11 years. But then I've watched all the people that get here at 8 o'clock and they're out the door at 9 o'clock. They're probably not gonna stay. That's unity. It can be built, but you have to put the effort in. Recovery. So my mind goes through the recovery process. My body goes into the unity of the fellowship. And then I feed my spirit through service work. That's our guiding light, that circle and that triangle. All of this can be given to you through adequate sponsorship. I'm a firm believer that all the problems we have in these 12-step fellowships can be solved through good sponsorship. But a lot of people don't want to. They don't want to do the self-sacrifice. You know, the other thing interestingly, is nobody I got clean and sober with. Well, two. There are two people that I got clean and sober with almost 11 years ago, but they'd already been around for a year when I got here. They've been my friends the whole time. The treatment center, the last treatment center I was in had 17 guys in it. Six of them are dead. I'm the only one that's clean and sober. I don't know if that's a reflection of the statistics. If that is the case, one, maybe two of you in this room are going to get clean, stay clean, and die clean. Why? Is it because we don't have enough guys and gals out there carrying this message? Maybe. I don't know. I don't know where we're missing the beat. I'm not going to sit here and try to guess. I just think it's really sad. I do a lot of conventions and weekend events, and I have noticed when they say when they do the countdowns, 1 to 5, ton of people. 5 to 7 starts to go down. 10 to 15, not a lot of people. 15 to 20, even less. And 20 and above, you know it. Why is that? My late grand sponsor used to say very, very few people walk into these 12-step fellowships, get clean and sober, stay clean and sober, and die clean and sober. And what he said 12, 13 years ago still holds true in my experience and what I'm watching. But I will tell you, of all the individuals I've seen actually work the 12 steps, make as many amends as possible, learn how to practice a 10th step of taking an inventory of yourself all day long, and develop a network of closed-mouth friends, learn how to pray, learn how to meditate, and you sacrifice your personal time to be of service, that's 100% success rate if you stay active in it. But a lot of people, they're not here for the freedom. They're here for the relief. So you guys, a question you have to ask yourself. Am I here for freedom or am I here for relief? Another question to ask yourself is, am I attacking recovery like I attacked a drink, like I attacked a crack pipe, like I attacked a syringe? If you're a mad dog out there, you may have to be a mad dog in here. So I get arrested, and I sit up in that jail. Now, granted, I woke up on October 29th. This is the evening of November 4th when I get arrested. I laid down once during that entire five-day period. At that point, I'm drinking a lot. I've got a 160 milligram a day Oxycontin habit. I'm smoking DMT and I'm smoking crack. Been up for these 5 days and I get separated, right? I stay up all night and I'm sitting on the edge of the cot in my cell. And what I'm going to describe to you is the spiritual. My spirit began to address me, so to speak. My friend Jason, in 2003, on my birthday, died of a drug overdose. Right? On the way to my house, he stopped in Asheville, North Carolina, and he never woke up. November 5th, my rebirth date, I always like calling it rebirth as opposed to my sobriety date. I just feel like I was reborn, was his birthday. And so I'm sitting on the edge of the cot in my cell. And it was an overwhelming realization that was not created by my cognitive thinking mind. It was almost planted. This is your new sobriety date. And I came to believe in that moment in a power greater than myself, because I didn't believe it was a coincidence. What I believed was something in the universe made that happen to talk to me, to communicate with me. There was an importance, a significant event had just taken place. And I was in an inner city jail, the equivalent of Rice Street here. If any of you have been to Rice Street, this is what Duval County is like. And it wasn't easy being in there. I was in there for 5 weeks, and every time I left my cell, it was an ordeal dealing with everything. And finally, I started going to Bible study because I just wanted to get out of the cell. And I would sit in, they'd go off in the corner of the pod, like 10 or 12 guys, and they would read these scriptures and they would start talking about them. And many times I would hear a man say something that I heard you say in a meeting. I heard someone say it in a meeting in those 3 years I'd gone to meetings. And so the message began to direct me to the 12 steps. Like, I knew I had to go back to the 12 steps. For some reason, I just knew it. Nothing in me discounted what was happening. The voice of the liar, everybody has a voice in your head that lies to you. It's always active, but for some reason, when we experience a surrender, it goes into remission. It gets really low, and it's not as dominant as it usually is. And for whatever reason, that voice that typically tells me, that's whatever, wasn't there. And so I said, okay. And I started thinking about the 12-step meetings, and this guy Randy and this guy Dante, they just came. And I knew I had to go find these two men. One would become my sponsor, the other my grand sponsor. And I knew what meeting I had to go back to. I was being directed. Like, I knew everything that had to happen, but I had no way of getting there. I'm in this county jail. And so for the first time in my struggle with addiction, my family finally was done with me. The best thing my mom and my dad and my brother and my best friend ever did was when I called home from Duval County, they said they didn't want anything to do with me. They said I belonged in that jail. The greatest gift any of them have ever given me. Because the degree of aloneness that I experienced, it left me at a turning point with no plan and design of how I was going to manipulate my way out of this. I had nothing. And my mom, I'd had very little communication with her of late. And I had another guy who was involved in that business with me who got me a lawyer. And I went to my arraignment finally, because I hadn't been going to the arraignment. I'd been in there for, 10, 12 days. Finally go to arraignment. They had us shackled at our ankles and our wrists, and they trucked us into this courtroom across from the jail. And my lawyer approached me, and I said, hey, have you spoken to my mom by any chance? And he goes, yeah, she's in the gallery. So this is where I was split wide open by existence. This is how I describe it. Something in me shattered. I turned and I looked at my mother, and for the first time, I, on a different scale, I saw the collateral damage and the devastation that we cause other people. My mom had not slept in quite some time. I could tell she was real skinny, real frail, and she almost collapsed in the courtroom. And in that instant and in that moment, doing that to other people became unacceptable. So when I sponsor guys, we don't talk about acceptance. We talk about unacceptance. Because here's the reality. When things become unacceptable, we usually decide to do something new. As long as things are acceptable, we're not going to do a damn thing. It'll be our excuse. So this is about unacceptance. Is the way you're living acceptable to you? I hope it's not. I hope it's reached a degree of unacceptance. And now when you see that it's unacceptable and you see you can't do anything different, then you begin to venture on the admission of powerlessness. And once you enter the admission of powerlessness, the only solution is access to power, which is what the 12 steps are about. But as long as you're in denial or reject your first step, or you're in delusion and can't even see it, these steps that I'm talking about are going to look like a mountain when they're not. Talking about God, I don't want to do it. Writing inventory, doing a fifth step, looking at your character defects, making a list of the people you've harmed and the money you owe and actually going out and paying it back. Learning how to practice a 10th step and 11th step, and then you're showing someone else how to do it. That's it. If you see the hopelessness and the desperation, and truly, if you see you're fucked in your first step, you'll do whatever you have to unfuck yourself. That's a simple way to put it. Excuse my language. Sometimes I cuss when there's no other words in the English language to get my point across. And so... 5 weeks into that stint, and being split wide open in that courtroom, the voice of the liar in my head went completely into remission, and I entered that window of grace that all of us get. You know, the first miracle in recovery and sobriety is the separation from drugs and alcohol. That has to be a quick miracle. The second miracle is the returning sanity, and that happens over layers and layers and time. Right, the sanity that has to return. But the miracle, maybe everyone sitting in here tonight has had a glimpse of that. And then you have a decision to make at this point. What are you going to do? You know, when we die on our headstone, it's got, for me, it's going to say October 12th, 1976- to whenever my spirit leaves this body. All right, it should have two dashes, right? It should have my October 12th, 1976, November 5th, 2007, and then a new dash and whenever it ends. And the question I have for you, among other questions, is what are you doing with your dash? You know, you're the only version in existence of you. I know we don't like to talk about being unique, but you truly are. There's no other copy of you in existence ever. You guys get that? Is it possible that we each have something to do when we get here, and the journey is to find out? And that's what the dash is about? And maybe that requires you to look at the dark passenger that you have inside of you in order to do that. I know in the beginning it's about not shooting dope and not drinking and not smoking. If you stick around with us for a little while, you're going to find out that's just the very first layer of it. Right, I know if I don't do these things, the possibility of relapse is high. I get that. But I don't do what I do to stay clean and sober. I do it because I am clean and sober. There's a difference. I don't know any other way to live my life now. I didn't know really how to live life prior to this process. And so they let me out of that county jail, and I went to this treatment center not far from here. And I got there early in the week. It was a Tuesday or Wednesday. And I said, look, you guys got to get me to Sandy Springs. There's a meeting and there's two men I got to find. And I know they go to this meeting. And all the guys around here always went to the Coming Group. And we used to go to this NA meeting. I can't remember what it was called, Solid Hope or something. And nobody wanted to go to Sandy Springs. And I worked on them and I worked on them. And they took us to Sandy Springs. And on that Friday night, we were late getting to the meeting. And it was raining and there's an awning out in front of the church. And there was one guy on his cell phone. And I got out of the van. I beelined it to the church. And when I walked up to that guy, it was one of the guys I was looking for. And I walked back into his life. And I said, man, I'll do whatever you want me to do. I do not want to live this way anymore. And that man met with me once a week, and we covered one chapter in this big book. It didn't matter if the meeting took an hour or 3 hours, we covered a chapter. He got me to inventory. I wrote my inventory. I did a fifth step. I went through the steps. He started me on my amends. And when I had about between 4 and 5 months clean, it was time for me to show another person how to work these 12 steps. And now what I'm about to describe to you is what I connected the missing piece. So this was, I don't know if any of you will identify with this description, but when I used to go to treatment or some type of program, I show up on day one, my tail's between my legs. I'm full of despair. I'm full of anguish. I'm full of shame. I'm full of regret, and I'm fearful. And I'm willing to listen to anyone at this point. By day 30, my ideas are starting to look a little better than your ideas. By day 60, I've now put some weight back on. I'm in the gym working out. The program I'm at usually at this point says you have to get a job. So by day 90, I've gotten a paycheck. I'm working. I'm going to a meeting every day, and a girl has started talking to me, and I think I'm in recovery. No step work. But what happens is life throws a curveball. Curveball typically happened with the female, or it would happen with money or something with my mom, and that would cause Tarek to require an anesthetic to cope with it. And for me, it would usually start with Xanax, Valium. I'd start smoking some pot, drinking some beer. Next thing, I'm on the corner of North Avenue and Boulevard. That's how it unfolded for me. And so I never had anything to connect me to day one. Day one would become a distant memory. It would dissipate. Anything attached to it would dissipate. So I'm sitting in this big book study and page 24, and I'll never forget it. This was one of my spiritual experiences. Page 24 says, for most alcoholics and addicts, they've lost the power of choice in drink and drug. All right? Their willpower becomes practically non-existent. At certain times, Tara can't bring into this mind with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation and pain associated with day one. So I went over to this sober living program this last time, and I had between 4 and 5 months, and I'm supposed to show this guy how to work the steps. It was a younger cat. We sat in the dining room of his apartment, and he had a week clean, and I said to myself, holy shit, I was looking in a mirror. I saw myself at a week clean. And I said to myself, I'm willing to do whatever I have to do to never sit where this cat is sitting. And that was almost 11 years ago. That's why sponsorship is so important. It completes the circle. You know, they tell newcomers that you're the most important person in the room, and I'm going to tell you you're not. If the newcomer is the lifeblood of our program, we all know that blood has to have a heart to pump through. And the heart are those individuals that are out there carrying the message and sacrificing their personal time to show other people how to work the steps. Both. You can't have one without the other. The first step bleeds into the 12th step, and the 12th step bleeds into the first step. And that was the missing piece for me. And so I worked the steps. I started making amends. I was going to meetings. I was working two jobs. I got back into school. I documented all of it. And I had this court case. And my attorney said, you're going to prison for 3 years. I'm going to try to get you into a work camp. And we're, you know, fortunately, it wasn't federal time. I had to become okay with that. And my sponsor and my grand sponsor, they tell me this story. And it, to this day, it just doesn't sit right with me. But they said, look, if you go to jail or prison, there's going to be someone in there you can help. Just think about that. It's going to serve a purpose. And that's a really cold thing for me to sit down and say, okay, if I go to prison, there's going to be somebody in there I'm supposed to help. It could be true, but it was really hard for me. It was a hard pill for me to swallow at the time. And my sponsor would say, page 68, say that prayer. God, please remove my fear, direct my attention to what you would have me be, over and over. I'd say that prayer some days probably 25, 30 times. And I documented it. And we had this idea that they had illegally searched and detained me. So my lawyer put together a motion to suppress the evidence. And 9 months, August 5th, 2008, 9 months to the day, My lawyer has a meeting with the district attorney. He's got this motion to suppress evidence, and he's got all these letters on my behalf from, like, employment verification. I've got my own I live in my own place. I'm working at the treatment center. I've got this other job. I'm back in school. My sponsor wrote a letter. I think my grand sponsor may have written a letter. And they dropped all the charges. No community service. I didn't have to rat on anyone. They just disappeared. And so this word miracle just resonated with me. Because a miracle is when you and I witness something that we cannot explain. What I witnessed on the morning of August 5th, 2008, I couldn't explain how that happened. But what I did was I took another third step that morning. Not formally, but I made a commitment to my Creator that I was going to live the way of life described in that big book from that moment until whenever God removes this spirit from this body. And I've been doing that ever since, to the best of my ability on any given day. And I share that with you to give you some hope. I hope tonight that I've identified with you. I hope I've shared a message of depth and weight. I'm also a guy who's not going to sit up here and tell you that the spiritual path has been nothing but unicorns and rainbows. It has been... I've had tremendous dark times in my recovery. I had 5 surgeries and a kidney stone in the span of 7 months, 7 to 9 months. My daughter started having surgery, so we had to deal with how to handle a kid that has epilepsy. Our house got broken into, so my wife at the time and my daughter have to move in with my parents at 4 years clean and sober. I have to deal with identity theft. I battled depression, like real depression, the kind where you don't even watch Netflix. You just sit in the dark. You don't want to get out of the bed. My wife went behind my back to my sponsor because she was so concerned about me. And so all of these things happened, and I call it the dark night of the soul because I went to a place where I didn't trust anything anymore. But it seemed to have, like, at times I'd be angry towards God, but then God would be the only place I would go for refuge. So all of those dark things that I went through deepened my need to have God. So they served a purpose. And then last year I lost my marriage and I lost my father in the same month. Now this man, this is the last story I want to share them. So I went through the inventory process with my father, who I described as a very violent drunk, who was an absentee father. In my first fifth step, I had 16 or 17 resentments towards my father. He beat me. He didn't come to a basketball game. He never remembered my birthday. He beat my mom. Both my brother and I physically assaulted my father when we were in high school to stop him from, you know, being abusive with my mother. It was that kind of relationship. And as my sponsor listened to my fifth step, I remember him asking me questions. He would say, "Have you ever been violent with someone you care about physically?" I was like, "Yeah." "Have you ever verbally or emotionally terrorized someone that you love, someone in your family?" I said, "Yeah." "Have you ever forgotten your family members' birthdays or not shown up at an event for your family?" I said, "Yeah." And he asked me every question related to every resentment towards my father, and I had become my father. And I'm telling you, because I knew of his alcoholism, if losing the power of choice applied to me, then it has to apply to him. And I, for the first time, had compassion for my father. And I went and made amends to my father. And that was in 2008. And my father and I built a beautiful relationship. Every Sunday, we had lunch and we'd go to a movie. Oh, if I was in town, that was our time together. I became closer with him than almost everyone in my family. And so when he was diagnosed with cancer, now his death certificate says liver cancer, but alcoholism is what killed him. I took care of him, and I sat next to him, and I meditated, and I read scriptures, and I prayed, and I had my prayer beads, and I just created the most peaceful space I could for my father as I was taking care of him as he was dying. And that's what my mentor told me to do. He said, "Your job is to witness." That's it. And I noticed how everyone else, that this mortality has a very strange effect on people. But I knew my job was to witness for my father. And my brother and I have an estranged relationship, very little communication. And it was one of those situations when I was taking care of my father, my brother would leave. And then when I would show up, he would leave. And so we never were with him. Then the Wednesday night before he passed, They called everyone to the house, and that was my night not doing overnight. So I get there. My brother's at his bedside, and then I go grab one hand. My brother grabs the other hand, and it's the last form of communication we had with my father. He smiled. And then he slipped back into unconsciousness. And I watched my brother break down. And it was the first emotional response I'd seen my brother have to my father. And then all my brother's regret came flooding to the surface. And I saw my brother be human. Because my description of my brother would be inhumane up to this point. And I saw my brother break down two more times on Thursday and Friday. And then my mom would tell me, she's like, you need to whisper in your dad's ear that you're going to take care of your brother. And I would have refused. I was like, look, I don't want him in my life. You know, if he ever wants help, I'll help him. But I think he's a piece of shit and I just don't want him in my life. Imagine the hurt I caused my mom by saying that to her. I had to go back and make amends for that. And I began to trust my intuition. So the big book on page 85 talks about our sixth sense. That's intuition. That's trusting that voice, which we develop over the course of time. And on Saturday, I get over there. My father's not doing well. And I've been whispering in my dad's ear, you and I are good. You can move on for the past 10 days. And for some reason, I remember leaning over my father. I was rubbing his head. And my mother was at the foot of the bed, and my intuition said, it's time to tell your father that you are your brother's keeper. And so I leaned over to my father, and I said, don't worry, I will take care of Chad, and I will take care of Mom. It's okay for you to go. And my father took his last breath and left. Now, the only reason I had access to my intuition is because of this process and a blessing from God. So as my sponsor says, we get these blessings so we can be blessings for others. I share that experience with you because you're not going to, trials and low spots are what's promised, right? The program that's in the 12 steps is not designed for when things are going well. It's designed for when things like that happen. And so what you have here is access to freedom. You have access to power. But you have to make a decision. And that's all we do here, is we become willing, we make decisions, we take action, we get results, and we repeat, 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 repeat. And then things start to change. So I really appreciate Matt inviting me here to share my experience. Thanks for listening. God bless you.
So much, Kirk. I really appreciate your message. And I have now asked Nari to come up.